the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Week, episode 76, recorded Friday, February 1st, 2013. I, Sony'd.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
Week.
Online.
This is AV Week.
It's time for AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tim Albright. I will be your tour guide for the day. With us this week is Craig McCormick, who has a brand new title. We're going to try take it out for a spin here. The Editor-at-Large at Commercial Integrator. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you guys doing?
Good. I just broke something, so hey. he's over there in Boston, but writes for... CI, who's a obviously a division of EH. Also with us is Mr. George C. Tucker. What is your middle name, dude?
This will be the second show in a week now. It's Jay.
Jay.
It stands
George
for James.
Jay. James. Okay. Yeah. George J. Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage. How are you, sir?
I'm just fine. If you actually want my given name, it was once George James Arthur Philip Tucker III, but I changed that when I became 21.
George James Arthur. There's an acronym there somewhere. That I'm
yeah. We're not going to go there, John.
All right.
My real name is David, if that really matters.
Really?
Really want to screw things up.
So where did Craig come from?
That's my middle name.
Oh, yeah. My brother-in-law does that. His given name is Richard, but he goes by Dwayne, so because that was his dad's name. My name, though, is really Tim. So not to confuse anyone else. We're going to talk about Cydia this week for just a slight second or two. Also, Belkin is either buying something or selling something. I am not quite sure which, and I'll explain that in a second. Also, AT&T and the wireless space. But first, since January is the month of technology integration trade shows, let's talk about another one. This week was the wonderful Integrated Systems Europe, also known as ISE. And Craig, this one's interesting. We have a couple of links on the website for articles. One was written by your cohort, Mr. Tom LeBlanc from Commercial Integrator, talking about the European-centric focus of this. It is a pro AV show, but it's also a residential one as well, because you have Infocom International as well as Cydia coming together. But Tom writes about the interesting spin that a lot of manufacturers take when they go into Europe, trying to you know sell their wares.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is interesting. One stat that came out is how many new exhibitors there are at ISE this year. About 25%, a little less than that. About 25% of the 900 or so exhibitors are brand new. So definitely some companies over here are seeing, you know, some new opportunities and definitely realizing that the market doesn't stop where the continental United States ends. There's definitely some opportunities for them to do something overseas and expand their businesses. I think a lot of companies knew that as it is anyway, but it's interesting to see how big of a growth there is this year.
And George, this is, I mean, Craig kind of hit it on the head. I mean, there's a lot of times, and I've used this phrase before, big dumb American, where, you know, we kind of get in our own little bubble and we think that we're it. You know what, guys? We're 300 million out of however many billion people on the planet. There are markets outside of the continental U.S. Guys like Control 4 went over there and started throwing around their streamers. ZTV, Crestron, obviously, had a big presence there. Premier Mounts, I think, had a really huge one. Life Size was that. I mean, you name it. If you're going to see it at Infocom and or Cydia, you probably saw it at this show. On top of that, you also have the fact that it's the biggest AV show by sheer numbers of attendees, over 40,000 again for the second year in a row. Is this one of the things where, one of those cases where this is going to become the premier show, or is it just It's the premier show for Europe, and we're still going to have the two separate ones here in the U.S.
You know, I tend to think that that depends on how the EU economy actually does lately. It's been in a little bit of a, you know, roller coaster lately, and lots of bad news about banks and leveraging and all that kind of stuff. But it does have a potential because the EU standard is a cross, you know, nation standard, so that there is a chance for very unified products to come across and say, this works there too. So if the economy does well and this market does really grow the way it's looking to do so, then yeah, it could be a real potential threat to a lot of American manufacturers and get a lot of traction in the U.S. marketplace. I agree. Although, you know, I'm reading it, and the 67-page document about the EU standards that Tom mentions, I don't think it's that difficult from what I've seen in the past. Now, I haven't read it in a while. But I mean, really what most of those things are is about getting a UL type certification, which is a European version. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to deal with the building code or building materials used differences. That was not very good English, but we use a lot of, you know, drywall and wood, and there's a lot of concrete there, and you need to have different back boxes and the stuff like that. But other than that, it shouldn't be that difficult for a fairly competent manufacturer to deal with.
Well, one of the things that was interesting, we produced a couple of really good shows, one for Infocom and one for CE Pro, and we had a lot of really good smart people come on and previewed ISE. One thing that came out of the CE Pro show was the difference not only in the electrical standards and all that stuff, but you have considerable differences when it comes to manufacturing or home installations. Yes, you're going to have brand new construction, absolutely, but you're also going to have 300-year-old homes that have got, you know, that have been retrofitted two or three or four different times to contend with as well. So, I thought that was interesting as well. You know, you just have a whole different set of expectations, a whole different set of problems and issues when you start talking about AV, both from a pro standpoint as well as a residential, when you get outside of the continental U.S.
I'm also interested to see what happens with the attendance kind of going forward. You wonder if this is one of those things that kind of builds on itself, that, you know, people see that there was 44,000 people there this year and say, oh, shoot, I missed it this year. I definitely have to go next year and check it out. And, you know, kind of how the organizers respond to that, and, you know, if they can handle it, you know, getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and maybe it maxes out at some point. And maybe that's what's happened to some degree with Infocom, that it's gotten, you know, kind of as big as it's going to get, and people are looking for something different, and, you know, kind of willing to spend the money to go to ISE and see something different too.
Okay, so here's a question for you two, gentlemen, both on the East Coast, so you can get to Amsterdam a whole lot quicker than I can. Should we go? And I'm not talking about AV Nation, I'm not talking about anything like that, but you know what, you're an integrator in a major metropolitan area, or you are, you know, a regional manager for either a manufacturer or, you know, somebody who puts stuff in, or you're an education guy. Is there a reason as a U.S.-based company, other than manufacturing, to go to ISE? No? Okay. Moving on then. Something that happened about a year ago. We started talking about AVB and the Avenue Alliance. And the reason I say it was about a year ago, because they started talking, the Avenue Alliance started talking about, hey, we're going to be at Infocom, come check us out, come check out our almost kind of like a plug fest where you can see how the different systems interact with each other, whether it is Yamaha or Biamp or what have you. Biggest beef, though, from a personal standpoint, not anybody else's, with AVB is the fact that the V, as in Victor, part of AVB seems to still be missing, and that stands for video. George, there's a press release that we'll have a link to, and I don't necessarily like press releases, but the thing that caught my eye was the fact that Avenue Alliance, which is the AVB kind of working group, has formed a pro video subgroup. Is this what needs to happen for AVB to move forward with the video portion, or is it just, is it too little too late and HD Base T has already taken their lunch and gone about their way?
I don't know yet. It is a wise thing, in my opinion, actually, because you're going to have two competing standards anyway, why not bring on the big boy video, which is going to generate most of your need for that kind of traffic anyway? I mean, there's very few of us two-channel guys around going, yes, I want to put my stereo over AVB only and, you know, video over another set of network cables. It's usually going to be both, yeah. Right? I mean, you're not going to try and separate it. No, I think it's actually something that's worth looking into, especially on the pro market side. There is a chance for this to fly in the pro, in the live staging, in the broadcast world, if not in the home and residential areas. This could still very well fly. It's got the backing of AES. It's got the backing of a lot of good organizations. I think there's still a good chance it could make a show.
Craig, is this something that they're just kind of catch, you know, play catch up with HD Base T, or is this a real shot at this?
I mean, there's probably some degree of the catch up mentality, but I think, like George said, you know, there's a lot of big players involved in this, and a lot of potential for it. So it's kind of one of those, like George said, we'll see what happens, and it remains to be seen. I'm not sure where it's going to go, but it's definitely good that they're at least giving it a shot, I think.
Yeah, that was, and I agree with you guys that that's one thing that I wish that they would have done maybe, I don't know, 6 months, a year ago, before HDBaseT really came out with, I don't know, displays built into it, so, you know, built in with it. So, moving down the line, Belkin is buying Linksys from Cisco. Craig, my first question is why? And then you think a little bit more about it, and I don't know if this is me and my inherent distrust of Cisco, but it almost feels like, you know, a Trojan horse where Cisco is going to come back and buy Belkin all over again. But do you think this is a good move for Cisco or for Belkin, you know, to get rid of one or pick up the other?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting move. It wasn't one that, you know, people necessarily expected, but I'm not sure kind of where this is going to go, and I sympathize with your kind of distrust or whatever the word might be for kind of what Cisco's motives are here with this whole thing. It is definitely kind of a weird move, and I guess we'll kind of see what happens as a result of this. I'm not really sure what to make of it all, to be honest with you.
And George, this is not the first time that Cisco has divested of a previous purchase, but it doesn't happen very often where they buy a company and they usually kind of integrate all the technology and just swallow it whole, right?
Well, it seems so, but I mean, when I first read this, I thought the first thing was like, we're going to have to start making a verb out of isonied, that was my first thought, because they did this with the flip phone. They bought that flip phone camera, or the flip camera, the flip, which was really getting wide traction, and then it disappeared. And one, I haven't seen it integrated into anything, and it almost sounds to me like they were trying to beat Apple to FaceTime and have some kind of personal teleconferencing communicator system set up. And I kind of thought that's why they bought Linksys, is to have that in-home leverage, using the name with the leverage to do what we all saw them doing, which was really progressing towards a teleconferencing way. But I haven't really figured out where they think they're going, and I'm not sure they aren't at this point. I mean, they could be a whole lot smarter than us, but I'm not sure what's going on. And they seem to be wasting chances with getting market integration, you know, or market depth into the home and the light commercial for teleconferencing. That just seems to be missing.
So let me ask you this, and that you make a really good point. Because Cisco has sometimes taken what is inherently commercial, inherently, you know, big picture, 30,000-foot view, and dumbed it down a little bit to make it more, you know, Best Buy friendly, I guess is the best way to put that. Do you think maybe their purchase of Tanberg and integrating that into their conferencing solution maybe facilitated or caused them to just kind of take the flip and go, no big deal. Let's move over here to where there's some real video conferencing going on.
Well, that's what I was kind of thinking. You have to wonder why Cisco is willing to give up Linksys. Like what they see the future of it as, and you know, maybe there's something in there that you know nobody has said yet, that you know that they maybe don't see it growing as much as they thought it would in the beginning, or something like that.
Yeah. That's also very valid.
You know, I wonder if there's an assumption there where people thought, okay, well, Cisco stuff will slowly be merged into the Linksys, and why buy the Linksys? Just buy the Cisco stuff on the lower end, and maybe they're seeing that. I haven't really been able to look at their numbers, but one would imagine that Cisco buys Linksys, you're thinking either they're going to keep them separate, or, as we've been seeing, more and more Cisco gear coming out looking much like the old Linksys stuff,
mm-hmm.
but it's under Cisco's name. So is it the Linksys technology under the Cisco name, or is it Cisco stuff under the Linksys name, and why not just buy the Linksys, the Cisco, even though it's maybe $100 more, but we know it's better, quote-unquote. They may have just, you know, undercut themselves with a brand misidentification or brand confusion.
I was going to say, I'm confused. you going back and forth. So
well, but when a company buys another company and they use the same technology,
yeah,
who's if one's bigger and more reliable and more trusted, who are you going to really buy their gear of?
Even if it's the same technology under the hood.
Well, that's what you have to wonder. Is it? But like, originally it wasn't. What's happening?
Yeah. Just buy a D-Link and be done with it. That solves all of the world's problems. All right, guys, this past couple of weeks, Macworld, which Apple doesn't exhibit at anymore, which is still weird to me, it was this past week, and Crestron came out with a master control app for Apple devices. Mr. Tucker, is this kind of Crestron's way of saying, okay, you know what, we get it. You're going to use your smartphones. You're going to use your tablets for control. Here's a really great one. Instead of buying a $3,000 or $5,000 or $15,000 touch panel.
There is definitely that. I think for a long time, companies like Crestron and AMX and Universal Remote Control and all the rest have recognized that the second screen, the mobile device, is a viable option for a lot of people. And it's the option of choice. Regardless of what any of the professionals like you and me or Craig say, you know, about having a dedicated control and having to fumble and it's awkward and it's not as intuitive, the market wants it and there's no going back. And I think this is their final way of saying, we've said we love you guys for a long time. Look, here's how we're showing you. We're coming to you now. We're not just giving you a product. We're going to come to you and show it off. And I think that's a wise choice and they'll probably get a lot of kudos for it.
Craig, is this also a way for them to maybe differentiate themselves from Extron and AMX and some others that, you know, they do control and they do have some sort of mobile functionality, but it is another level of a control app altogether?
Yeah, I would say that's true, although you wouldn't be surprised to see those companies also come out with the same sort of thing now that Crestron has done it. You know, that's kind of the way these things work. You know, Crestron will come out with it first, and then the competitors will come out with it, and we'll kind of let people go to their brand that they prefer and kind of go from there. So I think it's definitely, like you said, a differentiator for them for now, and we'll see how long it is a differentiator for them and what the future holds with it.
But you know, something very interesting though, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the rage at Infocom was everybody had an iPad app or was coming out with mm-hmm. one or was making an announcement with it. Last year's Infocom, everybody still had these. Even guys who didn't have one last year had one, but they weren't making a big deal about it. So this is sort of a way to breathe fresh life into a product and get much more attention for it in an industry that went, okay, yeah, you're expected to have it. You know, it's got to have an on-off button.
You are expected to have it now. I mean, I recently picked up a new receiver for my home system. And one of the first things I did was I checked the Apple Store, the App Store, to see if it had some sort of app. It did. It's not the greatest in the world, but it does what it does. But the one thing though about these apps, yes, you have to have one, and yes, it needs to be functional. But come on, guys, throw a designer a couple bucks and make it look pretty. I'm sorry. There are some manufacturers of some switching and control systems. I will not name names, but they are not in Jersey and they are not in Dallas. That they just look god awful. They look like square little pegs. And you just, all right. They're in Anaheim. There, I'll at least say that. They're ugly as sin. And they're $100 too. So anyway. Moving on. Cydia has named a brand spanking new board after it parted ways with El Presidente last December. New members include Robert Brown of HED South, Stephen Crawford of Brand Strat One, Mark Hodges of Forefront Innovations, and David Humphreys of Atlantic Integrated. Craig, are you guys all excited because Cydia has a new board?
Yes. Absolutely.
Hold yourself back now.
Yeah, I know. It's always you know, it's always good for the folks that are on the board to you know, to have some new blood, new ideas. You don't want to get kind of stale. You know, kind of have the same people talking about the same things over and over again. So I mean, it looks like it's kind of an annual sort of thing, and you know that there's, you know, new people, you know, coming in every year. So I mean, who knows how much of a difference it'll make, but it'll at least, you know, throw some new opinions, new thoughts, that sort of thing into the mix, and that's never a bad thing, because I'm sure there are things that, you know, the Mr. Brown, Mr. Crawford, Mr. Hodges, and Mr. Humphreys, you know, are thinking about that some of these others maybe haven't thought of in the past.
Sorry, you were naming them all off, and I immediately went to Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine, Dr. Howard, Dr. Fine. George, is this a great thing, or is it, you know, like Craig says, you get new blood in there, you get new ideas, you get new perspectives?
I definitely think the new perspectives would be welcome, although I don't know what is coming out of that yet. You know, there's the little line at the end going, the process allowed for a strong state of candidates, possess the skills, yeah. Okay, what are we going to change? What do you guys see as the tension? Put that out. That's what I want to hear. We've gotten together. Here's our mission statement. Even if it's like the anti-pollution global warming conferences that says we're going to reduce by 30% in 1 year, and everybody knows it's not going to happen, at least give us something to shoot for. What am I shooting for here? I don't know. It's nice for these people. I'm sure they'll do well at it, and it's a great experience, but I want to know what's going to change. Otherwise, yeah, you know, old boss is new as the same boss.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. All right, you are listening to AV Week. That there is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage, and Mr. Craig McCormick, the editor-at-large for Commercial Integrator. One of your compatriots over there at Electronic House, or across the way, I guess, at Electronic House, Craig, is Grant Clouser, and he wrote an interesting piece. We've kind of been on a 4K kick this month, and his piece is called What to Watch on 4K Ultra HD TV. Some of it's some stuff that came out of CES, and some of it's his own kind of just his views on things. The one or two things that I wanted to point out and get your guys' take on. First of all, CES, Netflix was demoing 4K streaming. Now, as Grant points out, it was a demo, and it wasn't perfect, but it was still there, right? On top of that, you've got Sony, which is, so I don't know about you guys, I kind of expect Sony to be there with 4K. But the fact that Netflix is demoing 4K, the fact that technically you can download 4K content from YouTube, is this where we see this coming from? Instead of some sort of physical media, is 4K the driving force of 4K content? Is this going to be the internet and that stream there? Craig.
Oh, sorry.
That's right.
Yeah. I think it is definitely the future, and until something else comes along to make that the future instead. But this is definitely, you know, kind of the next big thing. I think it's the thing that, you know, everybody's going to start to gravitate to, and obviously has started to gravitate towards. So I'm just glad we're not talking about 3D anymore.
We sort of are.
In a backhanded way.
Yeah. I would do 3D if it was 4K, but that's a, you know, it was explained to me that if you take 4K and you put 3D in it, then you have an actual true HD 3D, because it's 1080p on one eye and 1080p on another eye. So that's all I'll say about that.
Well, you know, with everything they showed, mm-hmm, was really, I think it's upscaled stuff, isn't it? Well, none of it was native 4K that I could see. It was all old films.
Yes, it was all old films, but it was upscaled. The YouTube stuff is native, but you have to download it. You can't stream it.
But who's recording it in 4K? How can it be native if you're not recording it in 4K? That's my question.
No, you can record in 4K. You've been able to do that for years. It's the whole red cameras and
Right. But I guess I haven't seen anything that's claimed it, actually.
True.
That's my thing. Although streaming is the way to go, although, you know, there is a huge debate going on amongst a lot of the people on the Twitter boards, the AV Tweeps guys, about the future state of a medium, whether it's going to be a physical disc or not. But I think we talked about it a couple weeks ago. But yeah, it's still going on where people are still digging bunkers and throwing hand grenades about whether or not the physical medium is here to stay or not. I think 4K streaming might just be the final atom bomb, as it were, to get rid of the physical medium, but I'm hoping so.
No, but maybe not. I mean, here's the thing. Regardless of whether it's Blu-ray or the next generation of a medium, there are some people who are simply going to want a physical disc. I'm not one of those people, but there are some people out there who that's what they want, right? And Blu-ray, I think, and I could be wrong about this when it comes to its storage capabilities and its delivery capabilities, it should be able to deliver 4K pretty well. I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, putting, you know, Burns' Civil War all on one disc in 4K, but you could probably make a set out of it. I could totally be wrong about the storage capability for that, but I think you should be able to at least, you know, put an hour and a half, 2 hour movie on one Blu-ray and be okay from a storage capability standpoint. So I don't know. We shall see. This week, Engadget has a story. The MIDI is celebrating 30 years, and it has a really cool video. It's a Commodore 64 connected to an iPad. And you don't really have to understand anything about technology to understand that's pretty cool. So, George, you have, you're actually one of my biggest MIDI head friends. How important is this medium, and how important is the fact that, not important that it's been 30 years, but when it was first developed, why is that important? Why was that significant back in the 80s?
Well, it was significant, and it's still very important, I think, and it's something people should keep an eye on, because it was one of the first cross-platform standards that actually worked. And granted, it was all bits and codes, but it was something that said 18 manufacturers got together and said, we're going to hammer this out so we can all sell more gear, but we're going to talk on a common line. They made it happen, and I haven't heard a single manufacturer since that's come up with a way to do it their stuff the same way. The home automation world, the remote control world, all of them have kept proprietary stuff for probably specific reasons, but they haven't learned a lesson. MIDI's going strong. The gear's still selling. It works really, really well. But what's exciting about it is MIDI is this really simple protocol that we can use for anything. I mean, look, I work in the live staging world nowadays, and we use something called MIDI Show Control, which is an offshoot of it for controlling lifts and moving lights and things like that. You've got MIDI itself, which can control almost anything from robotics to musical instruments. You've got MIDI Machine Control, which is used by the optical FosTech decks for recording and stuff like that. It's a really versatile and lovely, and I'm getting very evangelical here, but protocol that I'm just sorry isn't wider spread. But using it with a Commodore 64 and an iPad, I think is very steampunk, as it were.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there a reason, obviously the driving force was, well, let's be frank, money. Is there a reason that other manufacturers or other industries or other segments couldn't say, you know what, let's take the MIDI model. Let's take it and let's run with it. Let's say, you know, the two-pin, it's always hot, guys, and we're always going to do that. I have a story for you later about interfacing with an InFocus Mondo pad and the pinout for that sucker. let's just put it this way. They use all 9 pins, all right, for control. But is there a reason that as a control manufacturers or I don't know. Let's take CEC for example, and let's say let's all get together and use the MIDI model. Is it the fact that they're so freaked out about proprietary control and somebody stealing their intellectual properties that they won't make it easier for themselves and for their end users? Is that the deal?
You want me to answer that?
Yes, please.
Yes, I think that's part of it. Although MIDI gives us the perfect example for that. Here goes the evangelicalism again. In that it has something called a sysx command. There's all these standard commands, there's all these standard functions, and then there's a thing called sysx, which is your unique identifier for only stuff that only your unit does. Simple enough to implement in other protocols, no. I think there's an unwillingness, like you said, from manufacturers of giving up the Ghost on that, maybe having that niche market that, you know, now would be open to others to sort of wedge their way in. But I'll say this out loud. If that's your real purpose and your only conceivable tether on an industry or a marketplace, then you're just like the flat panel guys from the late 90s. That's going away sooner than later, guys. Stop it.
Hang them and bang them.
So. Bang them.
All right, let's talk about the wireless spectrum for a second. First of all, AT&T is spending almost $2 billion. They're buying $2 billion worth of 700 megahertz spectrum from Verizon. A couple reasons why this is important to us. Well, George works in live staging, and he can tell us why 700 megahertz is important. But it impacts the AV industry when it comes to wireless devices, not just microphones, but other things as well. Craig, is this something where we should just keep an eye on, or is there anything more we can do than just kind of sit and watch and read the blogs like Engadget and Gizmodo and The Verve and just watch with horror as AT&T picks up all this spectrum?
Yeah, I think it's something we kind of have to sit back and watch what happens. Like you said, I'm not sure what we can necessarily do about it, how we can kind of change it. It's here for the moment, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Well, and George, there's another story we have actually in our links about the FCC's Wi-Fi expansion. So, first of all, talk about why 700 megahertz is important to us, and how the FCC is kind of encroaching on our wireless for a second.
The short answer is that it was once not available to us because it was part of the TV spectrum, mm-hmm. off-air, you know, broadcast for analog TV. You remember the color picture sound spikes that needed all that space for analog. The second is that now it's, you know, like I said, it's open to us, but there's a whole big debate, especially in the live industries, the live events, staging industries, that they were going to take a lot of that away, where a lot of our wireless microphones hid. And when you replace an analog signal with a big old digital signal, there's no room to hide. You know, it's all about proximity and power ratios, and we don't need to get into it on that. We actually have a really nice special that was recorded, a year ago with the Sennheiser guys, mm-hmm. about RF and stuff that details that really well. We should probably put a link on this show with that.
Yeah.
And that turns into, like, Google was going after the 700 megahertz band. They really wanted it because it's a nice UHF frequency. It's got a nice transmission distance. It's big enough to go around stuff, but small enough to get, you know, your direct power, you know, sent from chain to chain. And that has a lot to do with the MuniFi that they've been trying to establish at times, and the WiMAX stuff that has been out there for a little while. And then we do the gigabit 802.11ac, which, mm-hmm. the FCC is now trying to make a full standard, which is not really for you and I in our home. It's actually, you know, a suburban metropolitan networking system that they're trying to establish and get a verification for. So all of this does matter because they're going to start slicing this up, and products that we're going to be offered will be specific to these or may jump between them. But it's going to be a very interesting way of saying, well, and when you get into New York City, it switches automatically to 700 megahertz. But when you're out in the burbs, it'll be back to microwave or 802.11, 2.4 gigahertz. Sorry.
Well, and it's also a way to kind of move us as a country because into more wireless internet and more wireless access. One thing that we have a disadvantage at, we're a disadvantage when you compare us to the UK or France or other countries around the world, is the fact that we are so spread out. I mean, it doesn't feel like that in New York or Boston or even in St. Louis. But when you start looking at Iowa and Wyoming and Montana and these big open spaces where you still have populations, they're just not as concentrated. And then because they're not as concentrated, you don't have the business reason to expand your infrastructure to service, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 people when you can spend that same amount of money and service, you know, the entire city of New York. And so it's kind of the government's way. It's almost like the cable bill back in the 70s where we as a people decided that everybody needed cable. And now we have the Kardashians. So.
And reruns of Hee Haw on three channels.
You know what? I would rather watch Hee Haw than anything with anyone named Kardashian. So.
This is a truth.
Yes. A couple more things real quick, guys. First of all, Logitech, who is known for their business savvy and their incredible decisions from a technology standpoint over the last 3 or 4 years. And yes, my tongue is in my cheek because they're the ones who spent a couple $1 million, $100 million on the Google TV remote and then dumped out of it, is dumping something else. And that's the Harmony remote. And George, you do a lot with the DIY guys. This is something that is in their wheelhouse. Is this a victim of the apps that we've been talking about, or is it simply Logitech trying to divest itself of a certain product line and move in a different direction?
I think we probably are seeing that they have probably too wide a selection, and as this market shrinks a little bit due to what we talked about earlier, the second screen remote mm-hmm. control being there, that they have to, in order to be successful, they need to probably narrow what their offerings are to be able to make a profit on those in the segments that will still buy it. You know, I still will buy a dedicated remote because I don't want my kids touching my phone, and they're too young to be giving them a phone for that. And that, I think, is just real business decision. And it's unfortunate, but you know what? The DIY movement has a lot of people making their own boards, making their own products, selling their Raspberry Pis and their Arduino systems that are going to probably take the place of some of those things anyway.
Craig, is this a good deal for or a good move by Logitech, or should they hold on to this to have, you know, an actual dedicated remote that's, you know, competes with AMX and Crestron, but not really in at a lower price point?
Yeah, I think it's probably the right way to go. And I did notice in the story that we're talking about here that they're also selling part of their surveillance camera business. So,
yeah.
So maybe there's kind of more going on than we kind of realize. Who knows? But maybe there's kind of more. They're just realizing that, you know, certain segments of their product line are not as successful as others, and it's time to move on and you know, focus on the ones that are more successful. So,
and can we put a big shout out that they didn't go the way of X10 and become really skeevy? So I applaud that.
What is your problem with X10? Leave them alone. They're dead and buried. Aren't they? They are, aren't they?
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah, I think they are.
We did a story on them like a year ago. They're gone. They went bye-bye.
Yes, well, but they laid a foul trail.
All right.
Did I say that out loud?
Yes. The Big Bang guys love them. That's all I'm saying. This is actually a story written by the editor-at-large for Commercial Integrator. Converting digital signage into revenue. I am going to use the heck out of that title, brother. You deserved it.
Well, thank you.
Here's the thing.
I spoke with.
Do what?
Do you know who I spoke with?
I spoke with the editor at large. The editor at large. I know him.
He bought a drink for me.
He did?
I just had to make sure it wasn't.
You bought George a drink and you did. What? Hang on. Time out. You bought George a drink?
No, but he has to now.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
Say, you like went up an escalator and I was going down and you waved hi to me at Infocom. That's all you I had time for at Infocom with me. Good Lord. Buying Tucker drinks? Come on.
That didn't happen. I think it was must have been the other editor at large.
Oh. He's had drinks with her as well. All right. Moving on. let's talk about digital signage and how to make money off of them. This is one of those things that everybody and their brother has been talking about for a couple of years now, about how exactly, Craig, do we make money on this stuff? Because, you know what? It's really cool. You go into, it was last year, year before last, LG had a very, very interesting display. Being a gentleman of a certain size, I am not shy about going to establishments that, you know, have Frosties and spicy chicken sandwiches named Wendy's. That was the display, though, for LG. It was a frickin' Wendy's, right? And you look at that and you go, okay, I can kind of see that. But for integrators, how do you get in the door there and say, hi, you know, I'm Bob from your local integration firm. Let's talk about, you know, jazzing up your menu board or jazzing up your advertising or something like that.
Yeah, this is a profile on Ping HD. They're out in Denver and they're an integrator and they do a lot of what you're talking about, you know, menu boards and in you know, restaurants and sports stadiums and convention centers, you know, all kinds of places. That, you know, they do digital signage all over the place. One way that they're able to kind of distinguish themselves and, you know, stand apart from most of their competitors, if not all of them, is they manage the content themselves. They create the content. So, they said that they're the only ones that do it, and talking to other folks, you know, it's at the very least a very rare thing, if not they're the only ones that do it in the industry. So it's something that they, you know, kind of have done all along, and you know they say it obviously sets them apart, and it's been successful for them. So,
George, is this something where Craig says, you know, they manage the content, they create the content? This sounds then like an opportunity not just for double E's, you know, somebody that has an electrical engineering degree, and, you know, a CTS or other experiences in the technical side, but also you take that person, and let's say that you have a creative person who is, you know what, they're not just, it's either not happening or they can't find a job in graphic arts. This sounds like an opportunity for them to get into an industry that maybe they never thought of, but hey, here's a road, here's a path for you to make some money, to make a career for yourself. It may not be, you know, painting the Mona Lisa, but it is, you know, graphical in nature.
Absolutely. I mean, digital signage has such depth and breadth of an ability to make some kind of profit off of it. Everything from using I think it's Roku makes the Bright Sign system, which is basically similar to their Roku XMBC system that you can do. You can sell a player and some content and the display stuff and a schedule, and it's a one-off sale with maybe an occasional maintenance. And then you can actually do which is the real money like Ping HD does, which is if you're able to sell the network, the systems, the displays, and the content on a recurring revenue basis, that's really awesome stuff. But digital signage work, we do it all the time for like artsy fartsy stuff. We do very theatrical or art installations with a lot of this stuff, as well as some, say, Macy's window. But this is something that has been growing phenomenally, and it's everything from a plasma display to, you know, almost the whole face of a building in Christie micro tiles.
Oh, that would be cool. I'm sorry, I like micro tiles. So let me ask you guys this, and either one of you, Craig or George. Is there an integration firm, an ideal integration house that is positioned maybe better than another one? So maybe let's say that you're a house that, you know what we do is pretty much, you know, residential and a little bit of commercial, but what we do pretty much is, you know, high-end houses and stuff like that. But we're interested in this because, you know, it's a good way. It's a good revenue generator. Or, you know, a big Mondo house, maybe not as big as AVISPL, but you know what? We've got three or four or five offices, and we do primarily commercial, and that's our wheelhouse. So which one of those two, or maybe a third or fourth option, should kind of get into digital signage?
Well, Ping HD is only about 18 people. Their employees are there's uh-huh. only about 18 employees there, so it's obviously really small. So it definitely could work if for a small company, you know, if they have, you know, the right mix of people, and that sounds like that's what they have there. So obviously, you know, there's more chance of it for working maybe at a bigger place where there's more employees, more money, and that sort of thing. But it can obviously work at a small place as well.
Well, and maybe the smallness is what gives them their flexibility, you know, makes them more nimble than a bigger house to bring on new stuff. So, alrighty. Well, gentlemen, that was the last story that I had. Thank you so much for joining us. With us this week is George Tucker, the engineering coordinator for World Studies. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
How can people get a hold of you, find you, stalk you?
Mostly on Twitter, Tucker2s. I do have a blog, Tucker2s@typehead.com, and my stuff is distributed on Red Band, AV Shout, a number of other places, but you'll always find it through my Twitter feed.
Very cool. And also the editor at large. He's the editor at large at Commercial Integrator. His name is Craig McCormick. One thing before I let you pimp your stuff, I do have to extend my condolences because Craig is a Patriots fan going into Super Bowl weekend. So,
go Niners!
Yeah. How can people find you and your AV as well as your sports ramblings as well?
Yeah, the AV stuff you can find at commercialintegrator.com. If you're interested in the sports and the AV stuff, you can find me on Twitter. It's Craig McCormick is my handle.
Very cool. If you want to follow me on Twitter, it's TD Tim David Albright. But more importantly for me and everyone here, please go by the website avnation.tv. Avnation.tv. You'll find this show, our DIY show, our EdTech show. We just posted our 1 year anniversary show. That's an education focused show. We've got the Live Life and a couple others as well. So check them out. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, Google Plus. Scooped in, and I started a Pinterest page just because, you know, everybody likes Pinterest. So check it out, though. Go to avnation.tv. avnation.tv. Thanks so much for listening. That's all the time we have for AV Week.